check the mic and make sure it sound right, boys.
Welcome to another episode of Cobb's Corner. If this is your first time listening, welcome, and to my returning listeners, welcome back. This is the 76th episode, so thank you for listening and downloading. On this episode of Cobb's Corner, we're going to be continuing our AFI Top 100 series, finally. I feel like I haven't posted in a while, with Sunset Boulevard. Sunset Boulevard is a 1959 film directed by Billy Wilder. Introduction. A screenwriter develops a dangerous relationship with a faded film star determined to make a triumphant return. Storyline. In early 1950s Hollywood, obscure screenplay writer Joe Gillis is unable to sell his work to the studios, is full of debts, and thinking of returning to his hometown to work in an office. While trying to escape from his creditors, he has a flat tire and parks his car in a decadent mansion in Sunset Boulevard. He meets the owner and former silent movie star Norma Desmond, who lives alone with her butler and driver Max von Meyerling. Norma is demented and believes she will return to the cinema industry, and is protected and isolated from the world by Max, who was her director and husband in the past and still loves her. Norma proposes Joe to move to the mansion and helps her in writing a screenplay for her comeback to the cinema, and the small-time writer becomes her lover and gigolo. When Joe falls in love with young aspiring writer Betty Schaefer, Norma becomes jealous and completely insane, and her madness leads to a tragic end. The story is provided to us from IMDb via Claudio Carvalho in Rio de Janeiro, Brazil. Big shout out to Claudio and to all my listeners in Rio de Janeiro, Brazil, and in the entire nation of Brazil, I should say. The movie is directed by Billy Wilder. He is known for directing The Apartment in 1960, Sabrina, which came out in 1954, and another movie on our list, Some Like It Hot, which came out in 1959. The movie is written by Charles Brackett alongside Billy Wilder and D.M. Marshman. Charles Brackett is known for his work on The King and I, 1956, The Lost Weekend, 1945, and Titanic, 1953. D.M. Marshman Jr. is known for Second Chance, 1953, Taxi, 1953, and one episode of Lux Video Theater in 1955. The movie stars William Holden alongside Gloria Swanson and Eric von Stroheim. William Holden, he plays our main character, Joe Gills. You've seen him as Sergeant J.J. Sefton in Stalag 17 back in 1953. He also played David Larrabee in Sabrina, 1954, and Max Schumacher in Network, 1976. Gloria Swanson plays Norma Desmond. You've seen her as Zaza in the 1923 film Zaza. Sadie Thompson in Sadie Thompson, 1928. And as Marion Donnell in The Trespasser, 1929. Eric von Stroheim, you've seen his work in Nicky in The Wedding March, 1928. Le Captain von Wolfenstein in The Grand Illusion, 1937, and as the other man, Lieutenant Eric von Steuben in Blind Husbands, 1919. Let's go to Cobb's Corner.
Thank you.
movie opens up on our protagonist, Joe Gillis. Now, Joe Gillis, the movie starts it actually starts at the ending, and the movie is narrated by the ghost of Joe Gillis. So Joe Gillis has been murdered. The movie opens up on his dead body in a pool. So whatever happens in this movie, we know that at the end, Joe Gillis ends up killed and his dead body lying in a pool. And then our narrator, the ghost of Joe Gillis, takes us, the audience, back about 6 months to when he was working in Hollywood as a small-time struggling writer, and we see that he's trying to pitch scripts to Paramount Pictures, which coincidentally this movie was produced by Paramount Pictures, and he's trying to pitch ideas to Paramount Pictures, none of which they accept, and then he finds out that he is in debt. He's in debt in car payments, and then he also owes rent to his landlord. And after trying to get a loan from one of the producers and from his agent, both say no. He's driving along one day. He starts to consider going back to work in Chicago, but then he finds the debtors, and then he's like in a car. There's a car chase, and then he ends up with a flat tire. Pulls his car into some driveway in some house in the Hollywood Hills, and then pulls his car into the garage of that home, and then realizes that it's like a huge mansion. He's greeted by Max, who's played by Eric von Stroheim. Max, who's essentially the butler of this property, he thinks that Joe is someone from the funeral home. Is it someone from the funeral home, like with a casket for, I guess, a monkey had died or something? So we're introduced to Norma Desmond, who is played by Gloria Swanson, and she realizes that Joe is not the person that she thought he was, so she tells him to get out. But then he turns around and says, "Hey, aren't you Norma Desmond? And like, weren't you a really big star back in the day?" Although Norma believes that she's still a star, because apparently she still gets a ton of fan mail, like thousands of letters a day from her fans from all around the world. And so she still thinks that she's on top, that she is a star, and she's planning on making a comeback. So yeah. So yeah, I guess that's probably like the first of my favorite parts. The next one would be when it's New Year's Eve. So at this point, Joe has agreed to sign him to start working with Norma on a script for whatever her comeback film is going to be. They're working together on this script, and he's essentially being, I don't want to say like interned or held prisoner at this giant mansion, but he kind of is. And the giant mansion is really kind of like the fourth character of this movie, in a way that the mansion and the fact that we've got this like unkempt, empty pool, empty backyard pool and an overgrown garden is a testament to the fact that time has kept moving forward. Time has kept moving forward, the world keeps on spinning, that Norma is older, people get older, people age, but Norma is living in the past. She has, like, around her house, inside, she's frozen in time. She has all these photos of herself, and she... All these photos of herself from her days as a silent film star back in the 1920s, and when she was at the top, and when she was still young and beautiful and at the top, and everybody was, she was the talk of the town. So she has pretty much rejected time, rejected this idea that the world has moved on. She's trying to live in the past, trying to relive and hold on to those glory days. And now she's using Joe to essentially write this script that will then get her to go that would then propel her back to stardom. And on New Year's Eve, she even throws a party. Now, this has caused her to be a bit out of touch with reality. I guess you could say she might have mild, like, dementia. I guess, you know, she's a bit out of touch with reality, out of touch with the real world. She's, you know, isolated. So, yeah, a bit demented. There's no locks in her door, on any of the doors in her house. Max has informed Joe that, you know, she's attempted time and time again to, you know, take her own life. And so it's a bit of a safety hazard. There are no locks on any of the doors in the house. No razors, nothing. So it's a really, really sad existence for Norma. And now back to the New Year's Eve party, because I feel like I've deviated from that like twice. The New Year's Eve party, she's hired a band and she's dressed up all nice, and she's even like went into town and bought Joe this really nice suit, really nice outfit. And Joe thinks that they're actually inviting people over, but Norma informs him that it's just them. That like for New Year's Eve, it'll just be them, nobody else. And I mean, it just comes to the point where like they're like dancing, and I think they're like dancing, and then Joe kind of, I think this is the part where Norma's sitting on the couch, and then Joe pretty much tells her, like, why are you using me, essentially? Like, why are you keeping me here prisoner? Like, don't you think that maybe I have a life? Maybe there's someone else that I'm in love with or whatever? Because Norma's really starting to become attached to Joe in an unhealthy and toxic way. You know, she's, you know, becoming codependent on Joe. And then Joe pretty much just, like, storms out that night. He leaves, and then he's out in the rain hitchhiking, and he eventually gets picked up by one car, and they head to a New Year's Eve party where he meets up with Betty Schaefer. Betty Schaefer, who was one of the writers at the writers at Paramount, who did not like any of his works. And so she's at this party, and the two of them, they kind of get to talk in about a potential movie script that they could work on at some point. Although Betty Schaefer, who they find out is engaged, actually, they later find out is engaged to Artie Green, who is played by Jack Webb, and Betty Schaefer is played by Nancy Olson. Yeah, Nancy Olson, who plays Betty Schaefer. So Joe Gillis and Betty Schaefer, they start to work on this script, and it comes to the point where Joe is sneaking out at night, and he's sneaking out at night and like writing this script with Betty. And there's one night where the two of them are walking down the studio lot at Paramount Pictures, and Betty says how she's actually a third generation at Paramount Pictures, that both of her parents and her grandmother worked at Paramount Pictures, or not Paramount Pictures, but worked in showbiz. So she's a third generation for her as a writer at Paramount Pictures. She's third generation, and how she was a child actor at one point. And the night ends with her saying how, although her fiance Artie, he's in Arizona shooting a picture, and I guess the picture was shot for Sun, and like now that it's rained for like, you know, a couple days, like now they have to like do some reshoots. but Artie's in Arizona, and Betty has essentially put herself at Joe's disposal. She's literally said, I'm at your disposal for the next month. Artie's in Arizona. I can work mornings, evenings, nights. So she's making herself really available. She's really invested in the script. And it comes to the point where she tells Joe how she doesn't want to get married. Like now she no longer wants to marry Artie. Joe tries to talk her into it. It's like, you know, he's like, look, I'm very happy for you. You're about to get married. You know, you should be happy. You should be excited. But then Betty tells Joe that, you know, she's not as excited anymore, and that Artie wants her to move out to Arizona, where apparently it only costs $2 to get married there at that time. I do not know what $2 in 1950 is the equivalent of in 2024, which is the year that this podcast is being recorded. Not entirely sure. Don't have my inflation calculator. But accountants, please have at it in the comments. But she doesn't want to do it. You know, she's really, really comfortable at Paramount Pictures. She says how, of course, she loves Artie and she will always love Artie, but she's just not in love anymore. She has now fallen out of love. You can fall, you know, you can fall in love in life, but then also fall out of love. So she's fallen out of love with Artie. She wants to be married. And her and Joe, but then Joe ends up driving back to that same fortress on Sunset Boulevard, which is actually the title of this movie, right? Sunset Boulevard. I forgot to mention that Norma Desmond's house is on Sunset Boulevard, hence the title of this movie. And yeah, he's coming back late at night. One night, Norma asks him if he's been seeing a girl, and to which Joe really just kind of dismisses it. He's like, you can't expect me to be like locked away in this prison for forever. You know, I have to be able to step outside at some point. That was in an earlier scene. But then one night he comes back and he's talking with Max, and Max reveals how he is actually Norma's first husband. Now, Norma's been married 3 times, and Max was her first husband. He discovered her when she was like 16 years old, and he even name drops 2 directors from the silent era. There was D.W. Griffith and Cecil B. DeMille, who actually makes an appearance in this movie as himself, Cecil B. DeMille, and then he says himself, Eric von Stroheim. And actually, the actor who plays Eric von Stroheim, Max von Meierling, he actually was a prominent silent era director, Max von Meierling. So, kind of an homage to, kind of the character paying homage to the actor who plays him, I guess. Bit of a fourth wall break. And how Max is the one who's been writing all those fake letters to Norma, and to kind of keep her in the good spirits and let her at least think that she's still on top, and how really that's her job. That's his job, to keep her on top and let her and tell her that she's the best. And he says all that to tell Joe that he can no longer stay at the fortress. He can no longer stay at Norma's house. He doesn't care, you know, where he goes every night. But due to that fact that he's leaving every night, like, he cannot, in good consciousness, let Joe stay at Norma's house anymore. So he's kicked out. He has kicked out Joe, and then Joe goes back to. So Joe goes up to his room to pack, and he sees that Norma is on the phone, that he's actually on the phone with Betty Schaefer, and she kind of starts talking a little trash, like, how much do you really know about him? Like, do you know where he stays? Do you know how much money he makes? And like, then Joe comes into the room, and then he picks up the phone, and then he kind of starts talking to Betty, And then Betty makes her way over to the mansion, and there's a bit of a confrontation between Betty and Joe, and the two of them, they kind of, I guess, end whatever either working relationship or, you know, friendship, potential relationship they had going on. Whatever they had going on, they kind of squash that. And Joe leaves, you know, he's about to leave, he's packing his stuff, and on his, and as he's about to leave, he finally unleashes to Norma the fact that nobody really cares about you. There was a scene, and I'm kind of lumping multiple scenes into like one favorite part. There's another scene where like she goes to Paramount Pictures and she sees Cecil DeMille, and like, and everyone's just like worshiping Norma Desmond's, like, welcome back to Paramount. So Joe kind of just goes off and tells Norma how no one really cares about you. You're a woman of 50 pretending to be 25. He said there's no shame in getting older. There's no shame in being a woman of 50. The only shame is in being a woman of 50 who thinks she's 25, who's pretending to be 25. Right? You're pretending to still be in your prime when you're not. You know, your rejection of reality, you know, that's you know, therein lies the problem. And, you know, she says how she got a revolver, and, you know, she looked at herself in the mirror, held a gun up to her head, she didn't have it in her to actually off herself. And yeah, you know, the ability for her to essentially kill herself. But yeah, you know, we realize Norma's really just not okay, and Joe is essentially saying, I'm out of here. So he's packing his bags, Max takes his bags to the car. As Joe is walking out, Norma chases after him and boom, shoots him 3 times, kills him dead. Body falls into the pool. And now we're all caught up with the opening shot of the film, the opening scene of the film. And there's all these camera crew and like all these reporters, even Paramount Pictures has come to Norma Desmond's mansion now that this death has been reported. And so the movie ends with Norma Desmond walking down her grand staircase because she thinks that all these cameras have come to see her, and now the camera's on her. She's finally walked downstairs, and, you know, she finally walked downstairs, and of course she's probably about to be arrested, but she's looking at the camera. Max is there. He says, lights, camera, action. The last line of the film is Norma saying, I'm ready for my close-up, and the movie ends with her walking towards the camera. And the camera blurs, and then the line at the end flashes across the screen. Deals with the themes of first theme that this movie deals with is reality, and the fact that time never stops. The world keeps on spinning. Nothing lasts forever. Everything is temporary. So do not get so caught up in your time at the top, you know, when you're still in your prime. Only downside of a prime, I would say, is the fact that it's a prime. It's temporary. It comes and it goes. Not just for, you know, actors in Hollywood, but also for athletes. And I'm sure, you know, athletes, any professional athletes that are listening know exactly what I'm talking about. You know, you see your athletic prime when you're young, when you're, you know, around my age, you know, when you're early 20s, maybe into late 20s, early 30s. But then as soon as you hit, like, you know, your early to mid 30s, it's kind of almost over. And I think that the same thing for Hollywood, especially any like child actors who maybe not all child actors stay in Hollywood and transition into acting as an adult, or some who get their start when they're already an adult, but they're already like a young adult in like either their late teens or early 20s. You know, it's like you have your shot at fame. You know, you're the talk of the town today, but then tomorrow you could, I guess, fall off, as we would say today. You know, nothing lasts forever, and yeah, you're not going to be able to be on top forever. So having that reality check with yourself is probably a tough conversation to have at first, but it is necessary nonetheless. The conversation you have with yourself to tell yourself that you are no longer in your prime, that the ride's over, that you're old, that you know, there's like an entire generation that's grown up on, you know, your work, and that you're not the talk of the town anymore. The next theme I would say is vanity, or I guess pride slash vanity slash narcissism, like a bit of narcissism, I think. In Norma Desmond's rejection of reality, she's become so narcissistic, so self-centered, you know, believing that she is still the best. Not only believing that she is the best, that she is a star, but also those feelings being validated constantly by Max, who is essentially, you know, who's her first husband and essentially her butler, her helper. He's validating these false notions, these fantasies that Norma has of still being a star, of still being on top of the world. So much so, in fact, that she's got nothing but photos of herself from when she was, from when she was a star, from when she was acting in the old silent films. She's got nothing but photos of herself in her house. So she has rejected reality. She's rejected the outside world, rejected the concept of time, and believes that she can just stand still. Just freeze time forever. The only way that we are able to freeze time is in the movies. You know, movies, they can freeze actors and actresses, freeze them in time forever. You know, you record a video, record a movie. It's set there. It is set. It's going to be like that forever, long after you're gone. But she has rejected all concept of reality, all concepts of time have been rejected. And she is in the belief, she has the belief that she is the best, that she is still number one, and that people are still talking about her. This movie kind of serves as it's a Hollywood noir. It's been referred to as like the perfect Hollywood horror movie. I'd say it's a bit of a criticism as well as a love letter to Hollywood and like the joy of making movies and sort of there being a lighting of the next torch of the next generation of filmgoers, of the next generation of filmgoers, the next generation of Hollywood actors, writers, producers, studio executives. You know, there needs to be a lighting of the next torch. Not so much a passing of the torch, but a lighting of the next torch. Those that are coming up after you. So, yep, the ability to know. And I think the movie Babylon kind of touched on this a bit. The ability as a celebrity to know that your time is temporary. To know that your time on top is temporary. It's not going to last forever. To know that one day, you will be considered old. Now, which brings me to like the next part of the themes and analysis. Toxic celebration of celebrities. I feel like we see this happen today as well. Just the constant celebration of our different celebrities. I think that the problem with this, the problem with this lies in the fact that today with cancel culture, it's like we could be praising celebrities one day, and then their career can end overnight. You know, their career can end overnight because of like something that they might have done that might have been taken out of context. I realize this movie came out long before the internet. So, but yeah, toxic celebration of our celebrities. And then, I guess Norma represents the celebrities who are toxically celebrated even when they're in their prime. Toxically celebrated to the point where they can, to the point where they're allowed to create a false reality in which they are eternally on top and the world revolves around them, which it does not. The world does not revolve around you or me or any of us. Now, so toxic celebration of celebrities, a bit obsession with you. This is kind of my last point for this section. This will be my last point. Obsession with youth. I'd say particularly with women in Hollywood, there's I don't even know if this is necessarily a problem with Hollywood or if it's like human nature specifically, or if it's like human nature or if it's Hollywood's fault. But generally speaking, there's an obsession with youth and beauty that I would argue maybe is older than Hollywood. You know, you can maybe claim, I don't know, patriarchy or whatever. I'm not going to get too deep into that rabbit hole, but the obsession with youth, and there was that scene, I didn't really get to touch on it in my favorite parts section. There's a scene where Norma has all these beauticians and like health experts doing all kinds of work on her face and her skin to make her look younger, to make her lose weight. And so this obsession with like youth and with beauty and with like, I need to look younger, I need to, I need to look younger in order to make it back to the top. And so there's that obsession that Hollywood has with youth and beauty, and it still exists to this day, obsession with youth and beauty. But I think that even as someone who is maybe young and pretty and who's maybe making money now, whether if it's be like as an actress or as a model or as a Kardashian, I don't really know what they do. All the Kardashian fans, have at it. It's like the ability to know that you may be young and pretty now, but age is going to come for all of us, men and women. Age is coming. All right? The world is going to keep spinning. You're not going to be where you are right now forever. And that can sometimes actually be a good thing. You know, you might not be where you want to be in life right now, but then if you keep at it, you put your head down, you grind it out, you hustle, you keep going, all right? The world keeps spinning, and you will continue to accumulate more wealth, experience, whatever it may be, over time. But then also, you may be on top right now. That's not guaranteed to still be the case that's not guaranteed to be the case tomorrow, next week, next month, next year, 5-10 years from now. The reality is that we're all gonna get older. None of us are getting any younger. The world is gonna keep spinning. None of us are gonna live forever. None of us are going to be able to stay in one spot for the rest of our lives. In the real world, Nobody's able to be frozen in time. That only happens in the movies.
I can feel the blood creeping up from the heathens. Got will, got fight, got pride, got reason. If they wanna go eat, then you know I'm gonna feed them. If you're coming for me, hope you're ready for a demon. I got eyes in the back of my head, I'm seeing. Take me for granted and you know I'm leaving. I'ma take what's mine with the webs I'm weaving. I could take this crowd from seeing to believing. Got a taste for blood and my tongue keeps bleeding from.
So now on to our last and probably longest segment, Sunset Boulevard Plus. Awards. These like awards and trivia, this is all from the IMDb page of Sunset Boulevard. So awards. Academy Awards. 1951, William Holden was nominated for Best Actor in a Leading Role. Gloria Swanson was nominated for Best Actress in a Leading Role. Eric von Stroheim was nominated for Best Actor in a Supporting Role. Nancy Olsen was nominated for Best Actress in a Supporting Role. And Billy Wilder was nominated for Best Director. So a lot of nominations at the 1951 Academy Awards, the Oscars, but not a whole lot of wins. Are there any wins, I don't think. The Bodil Awards. Billy Wilder won Best American Film. For Bedste Amerikanske Film. I'm not sure what language that is. But Billy Wilder won the Bodil Award for Best American Film, 1951. The DGA. Billy Wilder was nominated for Outstanding Directorial Achievement in Motion Pictures. Golden Globes. Sunset Boulevard won Best Motion Picture Drama. Billy Wilder won Best Director, and Gloria Swanson won Best Actress in a Drama. Eric von Stroheim was nominated for Best Supporting Actor. Charles Brackett, D.M. Marshman Jr., and Billy Wilder were all nominated for the Golden Globe of Best Screenplay. Italian National Syndicate of Film Journalists. Shout out to my listeners in Italy. Billy Wilder won Best Foreign Director, Regista del Miglior Film Straniero. Apologies if I'm mispronouncing any of that. Gloria Swanson won the Silver Ribbon for Best Foreign Actress, Migliore Attrice Straniera, I think. The Jesse Awards, Gloria Swanson won the Diploma of Merit for Best Foreign Actress. Laurel Awards, Gloria Swanson also was nominated for the Golden Laurel, Top Female Dramatic Performance. The National Board of Review, USA, Sunset Boulevard won Best Film at the NBR Awards in 1950, and Gloria Swanson won Best Actress, and Sunset Boulevard won Top 10 Films, became a part of the Top 10 Films for the NBR Awards in 1950. National Film Preservation Board, 1989, Sunset Boulevard won the National Film Registry. The New York Film Critics Circle Awards, NYFCC Awards, 1950, Billy Wilder was nominated for Best Director, Sunset Boulevard was nominated for Best Film, Gloria Swanson nominated for Best Actress. The WGA Awards, Writers Guild of America Awards, Charles Brackett, Billy Wilder, and D.M. Marshman Jr. all won the 1951 WGA Award for Best Written American Drama. 1952 Blue Ribbon Awards. Billy Wilder won the Blue Ribbon Award for Best Foreign Language Film. Exclusive Awards, 2003. Nominee DVD Premier Award, Best Overall. Nominee for the DVD Premier Award, John Barber. For Best Overall New Extra Features Library Release, for the Special Collector's Edition of Sunset Boulevard released in 2003. So that was 53 years after the movie's initial release. OFTAs, Online Film and Television Association. 2022, Gloria Swanson won the OFTA Film Hall of Fame for her character as Norma Desmond. And in 2003, Sunset Boulevard won the OFTA Film Hall of Fame for motion picture. Picture Goer Awards. Gloria Swanson was nominated for the gold medal for Best Actress in 1951. She came in fourth place. And William Holden was nominated for the gold medal of Best Actor, 1951. Last award before we get to the trivia. Cahiers du Cinéma. I think that's French. Billy Wilder was nominated for Best Film. He came in eighth place. The nominee for the Top 10 Film Award, he came in 8th place for the Cahiers du Cinéma. Right. Trivia. When Norma Desmond says to the guard at the Paramount Studio gates, "Without me, there wouldn't be any Paramount Studio," the words could apply to Gloria Swanson herself, as she was the studio's top star for 6 years running. Okay. So it's nice to see how they sort of made the movie a bit self-referential. The character of Norma Desmond is a bit self-referential for Gloria Swanson herself. So I always like it when movies do that. Make it like autobiographical. The character of Norma Desmond is modeled on the fate of several leading actresses of the silent era. Mary Pickford lived in seclusion away from the public eye, while both Mae Murray and Clara Bow have well-documented struggles with mental illness. Yeah, I know we reviewed Singing in the Rain on this podcast. I have not formally reviewed Babylon, and I'm hesitant to do so. But definitely in the movie Babylon, they do talk a bit about the transition from silent to sound. And we talked about this in Singing in the Rain. The transition from silent to sound, it was an industry shift that not everybody was like on board with, and a lot of the silent era actors struggled to adjust to sound, you know. So yeah, gotta learn to adapt, gotta move on. Unlike the character she played, Gloria Swanson had accepted the fact that the movies didn't want her anymore and had moved to New York, where she worked on radio and later television. Although she had long before ruled out the possibility of a movie comeback, she was nevertheless highly intrigued when she got the offer to play the lead. Okay, well yeah, Gloria Swanson, you know, she definitely was better off than, I guess, Mae Murray and Clara Bow. Yeah, you know, things change, you know, things that may be out of your control, you gotta learn to adapt, like I said in the previous bit of trivia. So, you know, good for Gloria Swanson, being able to adapt to, you know, sound and switching to now radio and television. So yeah. When Gloria Swanson finished Norma's final scene, the mad staircase descent, she burst into tears and the crew applauded. Even though it wasn't the last scene filmed, Billy Wilder threw a party for her as soon as the shot was finished. Yeah, I mean, I'm sure it was probably like not really like an emotional scene to film, but you know, it was a very powerful scene to film at the end. And plus, you figure like not all these movies are filmed like specifically in sequential order, you know. So I mean, yeah. Montgomery Clift was originally cast as Joe Gills, but quit the production 2 weeks before filming began because he had already played the kept man of a wealthy older woman in The Heiress, 1949. Clift was also wary of appearing in the film because he, like the character of Joe, was having an affair with the wealthy older former actress Libby Holman. Holman was reportedly worried the film would parody their relationship and told Clift she would commit suicide if he played the role. Wow. Whew. Man, I tell you, these Hollywood affairs, man. Whew. I mean, you know, poor Montgomery Clift. Montgomery Clift. I mean, I would have to actually like check out some of his works. I don't think The Heiress is on the AFI's list. I could be wrong. But yeah, these Hollywood affairs. Yes, yeah, it's a lot. It's a lot. Cameo. Jay Livingston and Ray Evans, the Paramount songwriting duo, is seen at the piano of Artie Green's New Year's Eve party. They are singing a parody of their song Buttons and Bows from The Paleface, 1948, for which they won an Oscar in 1949, the year this film was made. Okay. I kind of picked up a bit on that, you know, like Buttons and Bows. Like I kind of figured, like, the piano players at that New Year's Eve party. I'm like, this sounds like either a parody or like a real song. So yeah, you know, good for Jay Livingston and Ray Evans, you know, making that cameo. Hedda Hopper at the top of the stairwell as Norma descends toward the cameras. Hedda Hopper. I'm now going on to the IMDb page. Hedda Hopper was an actress. An actress from the 1920s and 30s, it looks like. She was in Men Must Fist, Dracula's Daughter, Men Must Fight, Dracula's Daughter, and The Last of Mrs. Cheney. So, yeah. I think she makes an appearance probably as herself. And then Cecil B. DeMille, who I talked about earlier, at the studio during Norma's mix. Cecil B. DeMille makes that cameo as himself. You know, he was a very prominent director during the silent era. So, a bit of goofs. Goofs in continuity. When Joe Gills is first reading Norma's script at our house, she tosses him a bundle of pages to read. The sheets in this bundle are all askew, but the bundle he catches is neat and aligned. You know, movie magic between takes, you know. Movie magic. It was askew and now it's all aligned, yeah. So when Joe is initially examining the scripts, Norma is shown with a very short cigarette butt. The camera pans to Joe and then back to Norma, whose cigarette is now, seconds later, significantly longer. Okay, I wonder if that was intentional or if that was a mistake. You know, these things happen in movies, you know, blocking and that sort of thing. Stay away from cigarettes, to all my listeners. I hope and pray that none of you are smokers, and those of you listening to Cobb's Corner that do smoke or vape, alright, knock it off. It's not good for you. You are chopping years off of your life. Alright. After Joe takes a dip in the pool with while Norma sits sunning herself, he gets out of the pool and dries his face and chest completely. In the next shot, he is dripping water from his face and chest. Oh man, these eagle-eyed viewers on IMDb, I mean, we appreciate you here at Cop's Corner. When Joe drops the slave market scene into a wastebasket and he and Norma have their first wastebasket, he and Norma have their first argument about the Salome script, she orders him to put it back in. Instead of fishing it out of the wastebasket, he picks the discarded page up from the edge of the desk. Huh. Wow. That was a nice little sleight of hand. Yeah. When Norma and Joe are being driven to Paramount, Norma raises her left hand to the left side of her face as Max adjusts the rear view mirror. After the cut, Norma's reflection in the mirror shows her hand immediately relocated to the right side of her face. Hmm. Well, you figure mirrors and like making them sort of like different and, you know, reflections. So yeah, you know, Justin Timberlake can tell us all about mirrors. You know, thank you, JT. I'm assuming that you listen to Cop's Corner, right? Or for anybody who's listening to Cop's Corner that knows Justin Timberlake, you know, big shout out. Justin Timberlake. Factual errors. During the bridge game with the Waxworks, the auto repo men magically appear at Norma's door, but no doorbell is ever heard. True. That is true. I never, well, thinking back, like now I realize that in retrospect, but yeah, that is true. There was no doorbell. We're going to reveal some mistakes. As the policemen run toward the pool, you can see the dead man's head lift up out of the water. I kind of picked up on that. And I'm wondering, like, did they actually have a professional diver hold his breath, or did they have just like a prosthetic dummy? Or I don't know if prosthetics were a thing back then. This is 1950, so they had to work with what they had at that time. So when Norma's car is pulling up to Studio 18, you can see that the driver is clearly not Max, as Eric von Stroheim did not drive. Furthermore, the uniforms are quite different. Very, very true. When Norma Desmond drives through the Paramount Gate, Jonesy, the guard who let her in, dials his phone and speaks into the phone, asking for stage 18 before the phone's dial has even returned to zero. Wow. Movie magic. When Joe returns to the mansion after having been in the rain in a Visuna coat twice, don't show signs of being wet. Well, they had like a costume change, maybe, you know. Or just magically dried off, you know. Gillis comes to Sheldrake's office, destitute, and begging to do absolutely any kind of work to earn a little money. Sheldrick apologizes for having nothing, but when he suggests turning Joe's script Bases Loaded into a Betty Hutton musical, Joe winces and asks him if he's kidding, even though a rewriting of his original script would entail a great deal of paid work for him. Okay. Should have just taken the offer from Sheldrick, Joe. Audio-visual unsynchronized. When Max is telling Joe about directing Madame's first pictures, there's a bad dub of the word 16. I picked up on that. I definitely picked up on that. After the Roscoe Fatty Arbuckle trial and the subsequent establishment of the Hayes office to enforce the new production code, the producers were concerned that the original age of 14 would be considered child porn and had the line changed in post. Okay, so I definitely picked up on that bit of audiovisual unsynchronization, but yeah, that dubbing of 16, yep, like you can even kind of hear it. You can kind of hear, like, this is not his voice. This is like a normal voice. Like, at the New Year's Eve party at Norma's house, we hear someone plucking a violin, but when we look at the orchestra, they are all playing with their bows. True. We had some crew and equipment visible. The shadow of a camera as it moves in on Norma's bed is visible on Joe's back. I'm sure it is. When Joe Gillis gets out of the pool and Norma offers to dry him off, several crew members, as well as lighting, microphones, and other equipment, are reflected in Norma's large, dark sunglasses. Yes, they were. Thank you again, eagle-eyed viewers. You know, they were just making sure. They had to make sure that, everything was copacetic on set, you know, so I'm like, but yeah, maybe get non-reflective sunglasses. I don't know if those are... I'm assuming that those are a thing in 1950. It's 2024. When Joe enters his bedroom and turns on the light, a crew member's arm with a wristwatch is visible in the mirror next to the door. As Joe approaches the suicidal Norma lying in her bed, shadows of the tracking camera and reflections from extraneous lights can be seen moving across the back of his overcoat. I feel like for most movies like before 1970, there's going to be a lot of crew and equipment visual. I can only imagine Well, we're going to find out when we review Some Like It Hot in 2 weeks. I can only imagine. Errors in geography. While Norma meets with C.B. DeMille, Joe spots Betty and bops into her office. The individual shots of Joe and Betty show two completely different views of the same window. That is true. That is true. I kind of picked up on that. We got a plot hole. Great as Sunset Boulevard is, the screenplay never reveals exactly why Norma Desmond, Gloria Swanson, was unemployed. Unlike some silent stars, Paula Negri, Clara Bow, and John Gilbert, to name a few, she had a fine voice and she looked great. Yeah. They never really explained, like, why did she fall off? Why was she unemployed, you know, post-silent era? Did she just refuse to work, or like, what happened? Some characters made some errors in this movie. You know, some characters stepped out of line, made some errors, and we're gonna expose them right here, right now. When Norma is holding the screenplay being written by Joe and Betty, their names are joined by the word "and." This would mean that Joe, who is listed first, had written the entire screenplay, sold it to a studio, and only to have Betty revise/rewrite the script. Since the two characters were working together, their name should be joined with an ampersand. That's the and symbol. Okay. That's actually news to me. I had no idea that that is how, like, Hollywood screenplays work. Like, I know there's times where for certain movies, like the movie will maybe go through multiple, like, screenwriters. Like, I think even the movie Ant-Man, I know initially Edgar Wright had worked on the script, but then he left the project, and then Peyton Reed took over. But I think in the credits of Ant-Man, it says, like, written by, like, Peyton Reed and Edgar Wright. So Edgar Wright's still credited, but, interesting. The name should be joined by an ampersand. Okay. Norma tells Joe how Mabel Normand was a Mac Sennett bathing beauty with her in the old days, but Mabel was never in that group, having left Keystone for Goldwyn by the time they became a film staple. Okay, Mabel Normand. So, I guess, context. Mabel Normand, she was an actress, director, and writer. She was one of the comedy greats of early film. In an era when women are deemed not funny enough, it seems film history has forgotten her contributions. She was in Mickey, 1918. As Mickey, she was the Jinx in Jinx, 1919. She was Sue Graham in The Extra Girl, 1923. And Kitty O'Brien in The Venus Model, 1918. All right, so. And then Mack Sennett, producer, actor, director from the same era. He produced The Small Town Idol, The Goodbye Kiss, Hypnotized, and a 1911 short called The Ghost. Alright. So. Wallace Reed died in 1923, 3 years before Paramount's Marathon Street studio opened. Thus, he could not have had a bungalow on wheels on the lot, as Max has pointed out. Unless, of course, he was pointing towards Sunset and Vine, where Paramount had its lot at the time of Reed's death. Alright, so. Wallace Reed. He did die in 1923, yeah. Son of a writer, theater, producer, director, actor, Hal Reed. Wallace was on stage by the age of four. He's known for playing Don Jose in Carmen in 1915, Jim Conway in The Ways of Fate, a short film from 1913, Jimmy Dent in Across the Continent, 1922, and Anthony Hamilton Hawthorne in Hawthorne of the USA, 1919. This movie's a bit of a period piece. Norma tells Joe that she bought a revolver, but the gun is not a revolver. I noticed that. It's not a revolver. Yeah. Again, but I feel like that kind of just shows how, like, out of touch with the world Norma was. So, whether that was intentional or not. When Joe is sneaking out to work at the studio with Betty, he pulled the Isolda Francini, the Isolda Francini out of the garage forward. When he came back, he also pulled it in the garage forward, leaving proof that he was taking the car. Oh, okay. All right, I guess it was like, it was pulled in instead of backed in, so he's been like backing in. Okay, well, he's leaving behind evidence. Next. On to some quotes. Joe Gillis, wait a minute, haven't I seen you before? I know your face. Norma Desmond, get out, or shall I call my servant? Joe Gillis, you're Norma Desmond. You used to be in Silent Pictures. You used to be big. Norma Desmond, I am big. It's the pictures that got small. Last lines of the film. Norma Desmond to the newsreel camera. And I promise you I'll never desert you again because after Salome, well, because after Salome, we'll make another picture and another picture. You see, this is my life. It always will be. Nothing else. Just me and the cameras and those wonderful people out there in the dark. All right, Mr. DeMille, I'm ready for my close-up. Last lines of the movie. User review. Very special look at Hollywood. Not a romanticized view of Tinseltown at all. This Billy Wilder movie was more or less ignored on release the year that All About Eve took all the awards and the kudos. It is a bitter pill to swallow since it takes a kick at Hollywood's guts and has one of the bleakest endings in the whole of cinema. Joe Gillis, a struggling writer, finds himself in the dive of a Hollywood palazzo when he wants somewhere to hide his car. The house belongs to Norma Desmond, who used to be big in pictures, and Joe gets drawn to Norma and drawn into her weird world flickering shadows. The acting honors in this movie go squarely to Gloria Swanson, herself a star of yesteryear as Norma, who is superb as the actress living in the past. Not that she plays Norma as exclusively tragic, the scene where she impersonates Chaplin is priceless, but perhaps no one could get to grips with the demands of the part better. William Holden plays Joe, his breakthrough role, and he does the part very well. While Eric von Stroheim plays faded Hollywood director Max von Mayerling, naturally a reflection of himself, and newcomer Nancy Olsen plays Betty, a girl too nice to become submerged just yet in Dreamland's poison. The script is its moments of oughtness, but it is never, probably the script has its moments of oughtness, OTT-NES, but it is never less than interesting and draws in the viewer to the point where you are with Norma when she visits her old studio and talks of the joy of coming home. You are with Joe and Nancy as they fall in love among the cardboard settings of movie sets and in hall when Hedda Hopper watching Norma's last descent into madness. The musical version, which appeared in the 1990s, had the heart and soul of this movie in mind and was an excellent tribute to it. This review was given by DD-5 on March 21st, 2004. 20 years later, I agree. I agree wholeheartedly. This movie has its ups and downs. It's a nice, sort of takes a few stabs at Hollywood while also being a bit of a reality check for, you know, folks like Norma like Norma Desmond and, you know. Yep, I wholeheartedly agree that, yes, this movie is maybe a bit of a cautionary tale against, like I was saying earlier, the toxic celebration of, like, celebrities. So, yeah. The movie's IMDb rating is an 8.4 out of 10 and has a Letterboxd score of 4.4 out of 5. 4.4 out of 5 on Letterboxd, I agree with that. 8.4 out of 10... okay, I'm going to give it like an 8.3. The release date was August 4th, 1950 in the United States. The movie is in English, is also known as Sunset Boulevard, with the word Boulevard actually spelled out. Some posters have it billed as Sunset Boulevard, but Boulevard's abbreviated BLVD. Like Sunset BLVD instead of actually spelling out Boulevard. One of the main filming locations was at 160 Sunset Boulevard, Los Angeles, California, Norma Desmond's driveway gate. The movie was produced by the aforementioned Paramount Pictures. The movie had a box office, had an estimated budget of $1.7 million. $1,752,000. Its gross domestic box office haul was only $299,645, which is about $3.8 million in today's money. So, the movie did not make a profit at the box office domestically. Its opening weekend made $169,000. Its opening weekend in the U.S. and Canada. Its gross worldwide was only $300,000, which is about $3.84 million today. So the movie did not do great at the box office, although it is still regarded as a classic, given the amount of, I guess, praise that it's gotten, and also the message and. So, yeah. Box office numbers are not everything. Rotten Tomatoes gives this movie a 98% with a 95% audience score. I'd maybe give it a 95% audience score. It's a great film. Not taking anything away from it. Still a great film. The critics' consensus, arguably the greatest movie about Hollywood. Billy Wilder's masterpiece, Sunset Boulevard, is a tremendously entertaining combination of noir, black comedy, and character study. I never thought of the character study portion, but yeah. Where can you watch Sunset Boulevard? You can rent Sunset Boulevard on Apple TV, Amazon Prime, or Vudu. You can rent or buy it on Apple TV, Amazon Prime, or Vudu. You can also watch it for free on Pluto TV, which is what I did. So that's all for this episode's review of Sunset Boulevard. If you liked what you heard today, then don't forget to give us a review wherever you're listening from and follow us on Instagram, Threads, and TikTok to stay up to date on all things Cobb's Corner. All of that information is in the show notes below. If you made it to the end of this episode, I greatly appreciate it. Be sure to turn on those post notifications so that you get notified when I come out with new episodes. And tune in to Talk Time with Morgan Cobbs on Sunday mornings at 8 a.m. Chuuk Standard Time, live on YouTube, available everywhere else the next day. I hope that you guys enjoyed your stay here at Cobb's Corner, your one-stop shop for all things TV, film, and pop culture. As always, I'll talk to all of you in the next episode. Peace!
Check the mic and make sure it sound right, boys. We'll be right back. sound right, boys.